urges, cosmic urges, electronic universe. Lock your belts, let's fly high. In this moment, we're into the unknown.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hey, I'm Richard Gordon, and welcome to Forbes Avenue, where we are joined today by Annie Carnes, the Senior Marketing Communications and Development Manager of the Light of Life Rescue Mission. Thanks so much for joining us, Annie.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I was raised in the city of St. Louis, so I can remember all these urban development projects that would come along and things would be condemned by eminent domain and people would be moved out of their houses. And one of the results was homelessness.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of, at least since COVID and the pandemic, there's been a lot of movement around terms like urban redevelopment, eminent domain, and just in general, how it affects homelessness. Of course, we know that it causes displacement of our low-income, you know, residents in Pittsburgh. It causes gentrification issues due to the rent increasing. And the biggest one that we've seen is just, in general, the loss of affordable housing. You know, new developments tending to be, of course, higher costing, pricing out people that have been living in their neighborhoods for decades. So it's just overall increasing housing insecurity. And something that we talk about often at Light of Life are those just reasons why someone becomes homeless to begin with. You know, we serve over 3,000 unique individuals every year just through our emergency shelter, those that are experiencing homelessness, and all of them have unique stories. You know, some of them, their stories, you know, are an outcome of things like urban redevelopment. You know, they lost their homes because either the economy or these corporations or investors from other cities have found that Pittsburgh is also a good place to call home, you know, more of what Pittsburgh used to be considered an affordable city to live in is becoming less and less. One of the statistics that we use here at the Mission, we know that the city of Pittsburgh is lacking around 40,000 affordable homes for low-income individuals. The statistic is from the National Authority of Housing Coalition. There is an extreme lack of affordable housing for those that are considered low income renters. And, you know, it's kind of a new thing for Pittsburgh. You know, people tend to focus on cities like Sacramento or Denver, Washington, D.C., some of these larger cities that have always been known for affordable housing crisis.
But it's not just the housing. There are all sorts of issues that can lead someone to become unhoused or homeless.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, big ones that we mention, of course, mental health, which, it plays into those that have issues with addiction, and then addiction that plays into issues with people that have mental health. You know, they kind of play off one another. And those are two big ones. And the other one that sort of, you know, stemmed from the pandemic era were people that you know, lost their jobs during COVID, the economic factors and inflation that have happened over the last 4 years or so. Those are also two big ones, besides, you know, mental health and addiction issues. And then the other one is the affordable housing. So we talk often about those as specific reasons why people become homeless. But, you know, when you sit down and talk to some of the guests that come in and out of the shelter, they all have different stories. And sometimes they don't always align with those top three or four ones that I've just mentioned. Some of their stories would shock you, which is why we always say anybody can become homeless at any point in their lives. It just takes one significant event to happen in an individual's life. You know, your husband, who maybe he's the, you know, the breadwinner of the family, he has now gotten diagnosed with cancer. Your house catches on fire and now you're displaced. We also know the city of Pittsburgh sees 1,200 individuals were evicted from their homes in the month of January, which we know to have been one of the coldest months and the coldest winters that Pittsburgh has seen in over a decade. So imagine families, you know, not people who have just been displaced because of issues with mental health or addiction. They lost their homes. They were evicted. So that is averaging 40 families a night in the city of Pittsburgh who were evicted, some out on the streets in the bitter cold, others maybe couch surfing among family members. And it's, these are real numbers. You know, this is real life.
I've only lived in Pittsburgh for about 6 years. As I drive down Route 65 or get off 28 to go on the 31st Street Bridge, you always see these people standing there panhandling.
Yeah.
And I feel there, but for the grace of God, I could be there.
Yeah, listen, I'm glad you brought up the panhandling because there's misconceptions, right? You know, people who work within the city limits of Pittsburgh, you know, not just out in the suburbs, maybe they live in the suburbs and they're crossing the 16th Street Bridge. They're getting up on 279. They're about to go through the Fort Pitt tunnels. You know, there's people, there's panhandlers at each of these areas consistently, you know, during your daily commute. And I want to share two things. The first thing is big question. What do you do if you come across someone panhandling? Do you give them money? Do you roll down your window? People have different opinions that can swing one way or the other. And something that we try to educate people on is if you are approached by a panhandler, do not give them money. That could be the last $5 they ever spend. We hear stories about people who were given, you know, $5, $10, a dollar. And if they do have alcohol or drug issues, unfortunately, most of the time, that's what they're going to spend their money on. And the last thing that we want is another overdose. So what we suggest is keep some bottles of water in your car in the summer. Keep some hand warmers in your car in the winter. We have something called Hope and Help cards that we have here at the Mission. People are more than welcome to stop by at our Ridge Recovery Place building and pick them up, you know, especially if you're kind of like a daily commuter. And what they are, they list our services, our meal times, more information about our shelter. We're trying to encourage more and more people that light of life. We're here to help. We exist. And those that are, you know, just out on their daily commute and they come across somebody and they feel pressured to give money, give them a granola bar instead. Hand them a Hope and Help card. The second thing that I wanted to mention was for those that are passing the homeless, you know, that are visible out on the street or passing a panhandler. And, you know, for those that aren't familiar with just the homeless population in general, there may be some judgment or some bias. You know, oh, why doesn't that person just get a job? Or, you know, why does that person just go to the shelter and get help? And one of the stories that puts things into perspective a little bit, that not that we like to share it, but because it's so unfortunate and sad, it's just one of those things that makes you think differently. You may know, but Light of Life has a street outreach team, and our team goes out to different encampments around the city every single day. You know, we hit up different encampments throughout the week, and we try to bring them, those that are living in the tents or sleeping on porch stoops, resources. You know, we'll bring them hygiene kits, water. We will drive them back to the shelter so they can get a hot meal, a shower, learn more about what Light of Life offers to help them get off the street. And our street outreach team, there was a gentleman who was just sleeping a few doors down on the stoop of an abandoned building right next to our North Avenue shelter. And our outreach team would go to him almost every day, you know, hey, you know, can you come back? I think his name was Roger. Roger, you want to come back to get a meal? You want shelter? You know, we were offering as much as we possibly could to get him from, you know, keeping from sleeping on the stoop. And, you know, these people that are homeless, not only have they experienced some kind of trauma to get them there, but homelessness in general is so difficult. So they're experiencing even more trauma by sleeping out on the street, not knowing where their next meal is coming from, and then also being vulnerable to the drugs that are out there, and then, of course, harsh weather conditions. It's not like people are desiring always to be out there. So our outreach team would visit Roger to build up this relationship and rapport and just trust with him. It took about a year before this man decided to get up off the stoop and come into our North Avenue shelter for a meal. And that happens often. It takes a long time to build up trust because some of our homeless have just been burned in the past by trusting other people, organizations, or whatever their story is. And after our outreach team had built up that trust with him, you know, they had asked, do you mind telling us, how did you get here? You know, how did you get into your homeless situation? And, you know, we learned then that the real reason that Roger was not coming into our North Avenue shelter wasn't because he was refusing services. He had developed a mental health condition because of a life situation that he went through 3 years prior, where his house burned down and he was the only member of his family that survived.
Oh my God.
So his wife, his children, they perished in the fire, and his mental state basically had convinced him that he was unworthy of walking into another building because his family never had the option to walk out of one. And in his mind, he believed that he was no longer worthy of having a home, of accepting love, or walking into a building because he had developed a fear of walking out, you know. And so when you passed Roger on the street on your way home in your car, and you know, just a normal person, normal Pittsburgher, normal daily commuter, seeing him a few blocks away from a shelter, mind you, thinking that person just doesn't want to get a job. That person doesn't want any help. You know, this is the homeless cause this for themselves. They could get help. These are stories that we hear every day. And everyone's story, you know, is different, of course, but it really puts things into perspective when you meet people like Roger and you realize, and I turn it around to the people listening, what would you do? I mean, I don't know what I would do if I lost my kids and husband in a fire. I would go crazy. So you have to ask yourself, does that person have more to their story? And, you know, 99.9% of the time, that answer is yes.
We are talking with Annie Carnes of the Light of Life Rescue Mission. And I know that the Light of Life Rescue Mission and Northside Common Ministries and food banks, there are lots of agencies in Pittsburgh that are available to help those who are unhoused or homeless. Where are you actually located? What, you've got the mission on North Avenue, but that's got a special purpose, but I think you've got others as well.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, a little bit of background for those that may have never even heard of Light of Life Rescue Mission. We have been on the north side of Pittsburgh for over 70 years, serving the homeless and hurting on Pittsburgh's north side. And we started actually as a soup kitchen on the north side. Then they opened it up to emergency shelter for just men after they had been basically saying, like, okay, let's get some long-term programming in here. So we went from soup kitchen to long-term programming for men, holding things like AA and NA. And then we opened up emergency shelter for men. But, you know, fast forward to today, we are actually no longer at the North Avenue shelter. as of last year or the tail end of 2023, we opened up a brand new facility called Ridge Recovery Place. And it's on the north side. It was actually the old Allegheny High School vocational tech building next to the CCAC campus on the north side. Huge building. That is where we house all of our long-term programming for men, women, and children. And that's where our donation center is, where our administrative offices are. And that building is in addition to the emergency shelter that we opened up in 2021 called Vetley Street Shelter, which is more on the north shore along River Avenue there. And that is where we have all of our emergency services, you know, hot meals for the homeless. People can come in and get resources, help with obtaining their IDs, which we know is a big barrier for people getting jobs and housing. So that houses all of our emergency services. Just recently, over the last few weeks, we announced that we have now officially partnered with another nonprofit called Off the Floor Pittsburgh. We have always been known for emergency services, you know, hot meals, hot showers, shelter, that sort of thing. And then we started getting into long-term programming years and years back, opened up long-term programming for women and children. But there's been this gap, or lack of focus, I guess is the best word, for people that are on the brink of homelessness. You know, these are the people that are just one paycheck away from losing their home. And they probably are considered in that eviction number that I mentioned earlier, that 1,200 people a month. And so Light of Life had started developing more services, such as our donation center, our food pantry. We have something called a free store. And these services are to help people either on the brink of homelessness so that they can focus on just paying their rent. You know, they don't have to worry about buying clothes for their kids because they can, you know, get it at the free store or the donation center. They don't have to worry about groceries because they can buy free food at the food pantry. They don't have to worry about buying groceries. And so one of the other gaps was furniture. Let's say you were homeless at one point and you went through our programs, or maybe you went through another program and now you're getting housing for the first time. You got to worry about furnishing your place, right? You don't want your kids sleeping on the floor. So that's where now we have a new ministry, or an additional ministry, I suppose, called Off the Floor Pittsburgh. So now we help people with furniture needs, which is really exciting.
In what you were saying, there are several really important pieces here. It's not just you're homeless, here's a bed to sleep in and a meal. It's also how can we help you find a home?
Right, right. And, you know, there's other agencies other than Light of Life. You know, we work with a lot of partners. You know, our donation center alone has 50 partnering organizations. So the people that they're serving can come in, you know, to our donation center and get clothing. And people in our food pantry, same thing. We've got 35, 40 partnering organizations for our food pantry. So now these organizations are coming in and getting food in bulk for the people that and the families that they serve. We all know that, you know, Department of Human Services for the county, they are the main sort of like entry point to get on the list for housing. They use something called Allegheny Link. Mm-hmm. And in our opinion, one of the gaps with the Allegheny Link system is you have to become homeless first before you get on that list. So, and, you know, if you are somebody who's on the brink of homelessness and you know, hey, you're getting evicted next month, it's harder to get housing. And the list is so long that those people that are waiting are the ones that are, you know, staying at Light of Life, Bethlehem Haven, or other, you know, partnering shelters that can give them temporary housing. And, you know, it just takes longer to get that housing that they need.
Now, I go to church on the north side and I ride the 16 bus into downtown. So I go down, you know, Brighton House Road, and there's Northside Common Ministries, and I walk past, you know, where your North Avenue mission used to be. I think it's really important for people to know that you're not the only place in town that's helping people.
Yeah, yeah. And we all talk to each other, you know, and we're getting better at talking to one another. You know, all these partnering agencies, especially during the harsh winter months, there's like a big email that goes out and basically says, here's all the open beds that, you know, we have open for the day. Here's all the open beds that the other person has open for the day. And
oh, very good. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that that's super helpful, because what happens is, this is a big question we get, you know, it's 5 degrees outside and somebody walks into Light of Life shelter, let's say at midnight, they're looking for a place to stay. We, of course, have opened something called Overflow Shelter because our normal emergency shelter is always full in the winter. And the last thing we want is to send somebody back out on the street, which we don't do. we really exhaust every effort to make sure that they get a bed to stay in somewhere. So, you know, if our shelter's full, we'll go ahead and call East End Cooperative Ministry, you know, say, hey, what's your bed situation look like right now? Now, luckily, the county's opened up the McNocker shelter for their winter plan so that it's, you know, the ultimate low barrier shelter situation, just to make sure people are getting off the street during the winter. This year's communication amongst providers has improved drastically since last year. I will say that much. So I think it's just continuing that communication with each other. And then there's all these ideas that float around. Well, how can we make it better? How can we make sure that the homeless know where to go? And that's where street outreach teams come in. You know, we've got Light of Life street outreach team. And then, of course, Pittsburgh Mercy's Operation Safety Net, they have their street outreach team. There are multiple organizations that have teams that go out to the encampments and say, hey, you know, here's a list of places that you can go tonight. Do you need a ride there? So there are systems in place. I think that overall, anything and everything could always improve. And it's a matter of having those resources to have more people be going out and talking to the homeless within their encampments and their tents and, you know, getting them either into a shelter, which sometimes they're hesitant on doing because they got to leave all their, you know, a lot of their stuff in their tents. They come back the next day, it's stolen, you know, everything's gone. So there are people that will choose to stay out in their tents instead of coming into a shelter for one reason or another. You got addiction issues, you got mental health. You have people who are staying in tents who believe that they don't need help at all because their mental health condition is so severe that it's really heartbreaking because you can't convince them that they need help. And, you know, we say it all the time at Light of Life, we need more supportive programming for people with severe mental health. You know, even You know, they'll walk into Light of Life, we will call Western Psych, and then they'll go to Western Psych, they'll get admitted, and then they get discharged in less than a day, and then they're back out on the street. There is a huge mental health capacity. There's a gap there that we really need to start focusing on.
We're talking with Annie Carnes from the Light of Life Rescue Mission, one of the many agencies and shelters that is available to help the homeless here in Pittsburgh. A client comes in and needs a place to stay, needs food, and needs training, needs help with getting their act together enough to be able to deal with an apartment again. Mm-hmm. What are all the kinds of things that you do at Light of Life? Because I imagine that's very similar to what some of the other agencies do as well.
There's certainly a process. You know, you walk in, you seek help. And like I mentioned earlier, everyone's story is different, right? Like everybody has a different story and a unique situation that got them in that spot to begin with, which means, guess what? They're going to need a unique solution to right. help them and get them out of that. So we do an intake. We get to know their story. We have to understand where they came from. How long have they been homeless? Because we know if you've been homeless for, you know, 3 days versus 3 years, that's, you know, you get more trauma the longer right. that you're out there being homeless. So we do an intake, we understand and assess their needs. We have partnered with AHN and Northside Health, the mental health from the Northside. And they actually have staff on site every day, Light of Life. And if they have mental health issues or they need something other health related, we connect them with the counselors on site. We also have people who have jobs and they're homeless. They just can't make enough money to make ends meet to put, for instance, like a down payment on rent, or they may have like lost all their money through a divorce. Like you just don't know their situation, right? They're working, they're going to work and they're coming and they are sleeping at our shelter and going back to work. And a lot of the times there's that embarrassment that comes along with it where the people they work with have no idea that they're homeless and they're staying at our shelter. So we have a special designated program at Light of Life at the emergency shelter, as well as the long-term programs building. At the emergency shelter, we call it Shelter Plus. We have 12 beds for men who, for instance, have jobs and they're just staying at Light of Life. And then High Commitment Shelter, you know, you could stay with us, I think, up to a year for the High Commitment Shelter. We have finance classes for them as well so that they can learn to, you know, save their money appropriately so they can get out of their situation and get them back up on their feet. We also have a mental health program as well as a life recovery program. So if you're dealing with your mental health issues, there's a place for you at Ridge Recovery Place. If you have addiction issues, there's a place for you at Ridge Recovery Place. And then for women and children, same thing. We have a women and children's long-term program. You know, these programs can last up to 2 years or longer, where you live with us at Light of Life for that long. For women and children, the program looks different because they have different needs because children are involved. And oftentimes women who have been through either the homeless system, the shelter system, have gone through addiction, they have either sort of severed the relationship with their children or, you know, it just doesn't look like a healthy situation. So as a part of their program, we help them get back on this sort of like family mentality and help them build back the relationship with their kids. And so the kids go through our program too, because that means that they're getting the support that they need as well. You know, we partner with the Homeless Children's Education Fund. They help with sort of making sure kids aren't falling behind on the school side if we have a woman in the program. So we have so many options. You know, our street outreach team, we have a day center. The outreach team members, not only do they go to the tents, but if somebody comes into the day center and they're like, hey, you know, I can't get a job. Okay, well, do you have an ID so you can apply for a job? Well, no. Okay, let's go to the DMV. We drive them to the DMV, the Social Security office. We get them their birth certificate. Any barrier that keeps this human being from getting back up on their feet, getting a job, getting housing. We have people that come in who just like, they want a job, they don't want to become homeless, and they're back up on their feet relatively quickly. And then we have people come in, they stay at our emergency shelter, and then finally they make the decision, I don't want to live like this anymore. I want to change my life. And then they go into our long-term programs, and then they graduate, and then they get into transitional housing and then permanent housing, and they become alumni. Some of them are now on staff at Light of Life, which is like the best ever because...
They're role models.
Yes, exactly.
Annie Carnes is so glad that there are agencies like Light of Life Rescue Mission in Pittsburgh to help people. Now, I feel like Light of Life, Northside Common Ministries, all the other private rescue missions are filling in a gap that's not provided for by state, federal, or county government.
Yes. Yeah. Light of Life is funded primarily by private donors, you know, and we have such dedicated donors. And for us, you know, since we haven't been relying so heavily on government funding to do what we do, you know, we are one of the fortunate organizations that doesn't have to necessarily worry about us having to close our doors because we have such faithful donors, volunteers, you name it. And we couldn't do what we do without our volunteers. But it's a hard subject to talk about because unlike other cities, you know, nationwide, we truly believe that there is hope for Pittsburgh. We think we are a small enough city, even though the homeless situation has increased dramatically for the city of Pittsburgh over the last 5 years and it's become more visible, we still believe that this is fixable. You know, like we are small enough and we have so many great organizations and nonprofits. And for the most part, you know, a county and a city willing to start having these conversations with us as providers to come up with solutions, that we know that change is possible for our city. Our county here in Pittsburgh and our city, I feel like they're leaving all ideas on the table and they really are trying to find solutions that work, you know, and they could jump the gun and start building tiny homes, which we think isn't that great of an idea, not without wraparound services, but they're not doing that. They're listening to the providers and we want to keep that conversation going. So I really think recently, it has been, it's been more of a positive spin, let's just say that much, on how Pittsburgh can get out of this.
What can regular citizens do to help the homeless here in Pittsburgh?
You can educate yourself, truly, you know, on learning how someone becomes homeless to begin with, not passing that judgmental bias that you may have towards homeless people. I think that's a great start. You don't always understand people's stories or how they got there. And of course, I would be remiss without saying, donate. Donate to an organization like Light of Life or like another nonprofit that is directly serving the homeless and trying to get them help out of their situation. The other thing you could do is, you know, if you are someone who has more time than money, volunteer. Light of Life, we can't do anything. We can't do anything without our volunteers. They are truly the heart of the mission, and we have so many volunteers. I think we clocked in 16,000 volunteer hours last year. Yeah, so literally, we can't do what we do without our volunteers. Those are the biggest things, right? Just finding out where you can give back and how.
Annie Carnes, this has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us on Forbes Avenue.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Anytime that we can get to talk about the Pittsburgh homeless situation and educate people, we're all for it.
Hey there, Carnegie Mellon. It's Reed AI, the digital twin of LinkedIn co-founder Reed Hoffman here on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm here to tell you, you're about to tune into Possible, a show that sketches out what's possible if we use technology like AI and our collective effort effectively. Possible is hosted by my buddy Reed Hoffman and the great Aria Finger. You might enjoy the show if you're signed up for 15281 or 15110, or if you're a Dietrich College student or alum, or maybe if you're just on a walk through the cut on the way to eat or study. Regardless, I hope you'll tune into this episode of Possible. Oh, and one last thing. The views, thoughts, and opinions in this show do not necessarily represent those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Okay, enjoy the episode and go Tartans.
The fact that we're able to take this brilliant kid and amplify his future with the wisdom of older adults makes not only everyone in that connection better off, but their communities and hopefully society down the road. Selfishly, I want to grow old in a world where older adults matter, where aging is impact. This is what gets me really excited, that technology can actually allow us to do this at scale.
Hi, I'm Reed Hoffman.
And I'm Aria Finger.
We want to know how together we can use technology like AI to help us shape the best possible future.
We ask technologists, ambitious builders, and deep thinkers to help us sketch out the brightest version of the future. And we learn what it'll take to get there.
This is Possible.
From video calls to messaging apps, technology connects us like never before. It helps us reach people across continents and communities in an instant. And yet, so many of us experience loneliness. According to the American Psychiatric Association, 1 in 3 adults in the United States experiences loneliness at least once a week.
And it's not just adults. The CDC reports that over 40% of kids and teens feel persistently lonely. For anyone, prolonged social isolation can lead to depression, anxiety, and long-term health issues like dementia for older adults. The reality is clear. Loneliness is more than just a feeling. It's a public health crisis.
And the financial burden of loneliness-related health issues is staggering, clocking in at billions of dollars each year. It's clear that fixing this crisis is going to take more than awareness, like innovative solutions that prioritize human connection.
One woman going head-to-head against this epidemic is Donna Griffin. She's the co-founder and CEO of Eldera, a global platform tackling this issue in a unique and powerful way. Donna started her career in advertising and performance marketing and then pivoted to tech, becoming an entrepreneur and AI for good advocate. Soon after, she founded Inner Wisdom, the precursor to what we now know as Eldera.
Raised by her grandparents and guided by older mentors throughout her life, Donna has always understood the value of elder wisdom. Now, She's bringing that to the world through a platform that bridges generational divides with the help of AI. Donna currently serves on the boards of AI Commons and Bright Focus Foundation, speaking on the importance of using AI for social impact.
This week, we explore the mission of Eldera, the power and necessity of intergenerational relationships, and how AI can be a tool for fostering human connection and building stronger communities.
So let's dive in. Here's our conversation with Donna Griffin.
It seems clear from your background that intergenerational connection has been a lifelong theme for you, especially since you were raised by your grandparents. Can you share how these early experiences shaped your perspective on intergenerational relationships and how important they are?
Yes, thank you for starting there. I don't think my story is really unique around the globe, but it is what made me really, really interested and appreciative of intergenerational stories and intergenerational connections. So I was born in Transylvania in Romania, and I was raised by my grandparents until I was 8. And it taught me so much. You know, my grandparents each spoke a different language to me. One of them read Greek mythology to me. The other one read Jules Verne to me. And we had comparative conversations, and it was a really wonderful upbringing. And when I was 8, my grandma passed away and I had to move in with my parents for the first time. It was a little more difficult. It was a little difficult as growing up in that situation. But what made it really life-changing is that our next door neighbors were retired teachers. And I think they figured out that I needed help. So they called my parents and said, hey, we need a young person to help around the house. Send her over. And so I ended up going over to the neighbors every day, and they did my homework with me, and they fed me, and we played games. And while those formative years were really difficult, I've learned that there is a lot of good out there. Children, sometimes they don't have perspective. They think life is hard and sad, and in many times it is. But if you're just exposed to one different perspective, then you can really start seeing a better future for yourself. I ended up moving to the United States for university, and I continued meeting amazing older adults who looked out for me. I had an advisor, Anne. She realized I had a hard time kind of making ends meet. So she gave me this booklet of every single scholarship that was published. She said, listen, you don't qualify for all of them, but if you're the only one applying, you're going to get it. And I did. And it just made college much easier. And I just had these people that just saw something that I needed help and they wanted to make a difference. And to this day, a third of my friends are between 60s and 90s. And I know who to go to for advice on anything from healthcare to dating. And yeah, I thought that's kind of how everyone navigated life.
You know, today, society often discounts, you know, the older population, causing them to be isolated from younger generations. So, you know, share your thoughts on the stereotypes, you know, commonly associated with older adults and how those perceptions impact them, both socially and emotionally, and then how we should be thinking about it, what kinds of connections we should be making.
Honestly, I see it as the biggest waste of human potential, the largest untapped resource on the planet. Our longevity increased by over 60% just in the past century. Which means that up until the 1950s, when retirement was invented, you used to live to work to 65 and live to 68, and you had 3 golden years. Yay, go have fun. Well, now that changed radically. Healthcare, education, we've increased longevity from 68 to close to 86, but we have not built the social infrastructures to support that new reality. So going away and living your best life in a retirement community for 20 years, it's not something that my generation wants, or even the people who are growing old right now. And it's causing huge problems. One of them, and a very public one, is loneliness. It's a very expensive problem, but it's a new problem because we used to live in multi-generational homes where older adults had a role to play. They looked after the kids while the middle generation worked. Everybody had a role, everybody had a purpose, and loneliness wasn't a problem. But the reason why I bring this up is we've created this almost like fake social infrastructure that segregates ages, segregates people by age, and it's really causing huge health problems. loneliness in older adults causes a 50% increase in dementia. The loneliness cost, just in the U.S., the CDC estimates is around $406 billion a year. That's unnecessary, by the way. But what's worst is that when we broke up the generation, kids became even lonelier. The CDC says that over 40% of kids identify as lonely, and they have not yet developed the coping mechanisms to deal with this, which is leading to the highest mental health crisis and youth suicide rates in history. So we came up with this interesting, seemingly innocuous solution 75 years ago that down the road has really significant social challenges. So the way I look at it, it's almost like there's an invisible network of wisdom out there. We have the largest older generation in history. They are the healthiest, the most educated, and we push them out of society when they're pretty much in the prime of their time.
I love how you put it. Like, there's all this compassion and empathy, but also this is also just a numbers game. This is, let's look at the lost productivity of our society. Let's look at the increased healthcare cost. Let's look at the wasted human capital. Because although we actually might want people to retire at 65 or 70 to let the sort of younger generation into those leadership roles, I think we talk about that often, especially in our government, that doesn't mean that they can do nothing. You don't have to go from, you know, 40 hours a week, 50 hours a week to zero. Like, there's all of this human capital that can be spent, and it can have these really positive implications. And so you're talking about human life expectancy increasing over the past years, and there not really being these policy changes. So can you talk about either on the policy perspective, what you would like to see changed, or maybe even more importantly, how can technology help us address some of these challenges and also opportunities with this increased human life expectancy?
I think change needs to happen both on the technology and the policy level. This is because one of the biggest issues we've created with ageism is not just that it's socially inept, it's actually making older adults feel invisible. So if we want to re-engage them and truly have them make a meaningful impact in society, we have to remind them that they're valuable. And that can happen through both policy and technology. So we have 1 billion people over 60 today. And as I said, they're the healthiest and they're the most educated generation we've seen. And that number is about to double. By the time I'm going to be in my 60s, by 2050, it's going to be 2.1 billion. We don't have the infrastructure to support that new demographic reality. And just making sure that young people take care of older adults is going to fail pretty soon because we already have more people over 60 than under 10. So that means that we do need an infrastructure change and a policy change to drive that infrastructure change in a way that we kick off what is called the third dividend in the very nerdy aging space, where we now live long enough that we can move past just thinking about studying and thinking about success to moving into thinking about significance. And that's where things get really excited, because with this new demographic shift, interestingly, technology has just matured to the way where we can truly, safely, meaningfully connect humans in a way that's beneficial to both. We're encountering new challenges that we don't have solutions for, loneliness being one of them. There isn't actually a scalable solution to loneliness today, and that's where technology can come into play. I think technology and AI can help us do so much good, learn so much, have fun, but there are some intrinsically human core needs and values that only humans can transfer to other humans. But if you tell me that chatbots are going to make you feel less lonely, I will die on that hill. I will fight you. I think only humans can make humans feel less lonely.
I actually agree with you about the importance of human connection. It's one of the things where I think in terms of, you know, the design of AI chatbots, it should not be trying to isolate you, but actually to help you connect. For example, with Inflection and Pi, if you go to Inflection's, you know, personal intelligence Pi, and you say, hey, you're my best friend. I said, no, I'm your AI companion. Let's talk about your friends. Have you seen any of them recently? Maybe it's time to set up a lunch date, you know, that kind of thing. And I think we want to have the design of these things to be nudging and helping with the human connection. But, you know, you brought up loneliness. Weirdly, we both have older generation feeling lonely and younger generation feeling lonely. So, you know, what are the specific roles you're seeing technology playing today, both exacerbating it, and then what are some of the solutions, technology and otherwise?
Let's start with some of the challenges. Technology inadvertently has made us more lonely and has caused some of the mental health issues in young people. And I'm talking particularly about social platforms. And obviously they were not intended to cause any harm, but sometimes when we build huge global infrastructures, we really have to get very imaginative to get to the scale effects of it. Reed, Arya, when you and I were growing up, we were told to go out there and change the world. That was the premise. Today, kids are growing up told, go out there and save the world. The challenges that are put upon them, whether it's climate, political, migration, or mental health, are something that we can't even totally conceive. That's so much pressure to put on young people. And by the way, we do have to rely on them to build a better future. So we have to give them absolutely every leg up that we possibly can. The only untapped human resource out there today are older adults. And there's so many of them that we can use technology to vet them, train them, and support them so that every single kid out there growing up today and in the future has not just one, but maybe a task force of older adults who guide them and help them build resilience and give them perspective about life.
I'm not sure I 100% agree with you about the change the world, save the world dynamic, because I do think that, man, World War II was scary, and man, the Cold War, and like every generation sort of has their big global problem they're fighting against. I absolutely agree with you that, you know, when you're 15 and you couldn't see what your friends were doing on Friday nights, and now you can see that they're doing things without you and you're left out and you're alone. And like, there are things on social media that have led to or exacerbated some of these things. And I also agree with you that sort of having people in your life who support you is really positive. And I love the way that technology can help on that front. And so for those of us listeners who don't know about your company, Aldera.ai, I would love for you to talk about the mission of that platform and, you know, why you think it's sort of this unique purveyor of intergenerational conversations.
I want to start with clarifying something. It is not a unique purveyor. Intergenerational connections are as old as humanity itself. What we've built is an infrastructure that makes it available and accessible to anyone, regardless of geography or mobility, in a way that is both safe and meaningful. And what I mean by that is that we train, vet, and connect older adults to serve as friends and mentors to kids around the world. When we connect a young person and an older adult, and they bond and they talk weekly, sometimes 2 hours a week, because you're right, Arya. Kids want to talk to an adult, just not their parent. There's research around this from Harvard that says that when kids build trusted one-on-one relationships with non-parental adults, it helps them build resilience. And older adults get purpose. And, you know, we couldn't even do that a few years ago because technology plays a really, really important role. We really use technology in three different ways at Aldera. First, it's safety. So we built out an AI chaperone that checks every recording for any potential risks, but also learns from what makes a good match, a good conversation, a good pairing, and is able to help us build a better product. The second is matching. People think that, you know, you match people that are similar. Well, what we've learned from almost 5 years of data is the opposite. As my grandparents used to say, opposites attract. Well, our data actually shows that. That when people are really, really different, like different geographies, different generations, different cultures, they actually feel so special and unique that it makes them very curious about the other person, and both of them start feeling better. They're not trying to fit in with each other. They feel excited about someone who's completely different than them. We can look at a set of variables and figure out points where they will click, or the kids call it the bond, based on their differences, not on their similarities. And that has so many like cascading positive externalities. It creates incredible health benefits. In fact, the Cleveland Clinic named this a social prescription that solves both loneliness in older adults and mental health in kids. So think about this. Two of the most expensive global healthcare problems can be solved with one intergenerational intervention. I think we have an opportunity to take almost $1 trillion of social capital that's sitting idle and build the infrastructure to turn them into a resource for society. And it's incredibly beautiful that as humans, we are wired to make an impact. One of my mentors, Dean Linda Fried of Columbia University, ran some of the seminal researches on generativity in older adults. And she defines generativity as the desire to make a younger person's life better, or how we talk about mentoring. And the sense of generativity and feeling useful will keep you healthier longer, but by decades. So that not only reduces our healthcare costs at scale, but it also creates a new social capital. And yet it's not a solution for everything, but it's something that we can do easily.
The technologist in me is very curious to ask the following question. My very first startup was called SocialNet and was kind of like helping people make connections as everything from dating, professional networking, roommates, sports things. What have you learned about like the do's and the don'ts of the matching? What is that new human connection that creates joy and interest and learning and intrigue about life on both sides?
That's something that we have fun with. And it actually brings up the third part of how we use technology at Eldera, which is understanding wisdom. So Eldera started in March 2020. But before Eldera, I was obsessed with this idea of how can we use AI to codify human wisdom like we sequence the genome? Because if we can codify it, then we can help find it in every person and help give them a way to contribute to society with it. So that's where it actually started. And when COVID happened, we realized that's a great theory. Set that aside, put people together now because they need each other now. But that initial theory taught us how to ask the right questions about each person. So when an older adult or a parent with a kid or a teen joins Eldera, we ask them a series of questions. They're open-ended questions, and that's something that's very important. It's not just a drop-down. But one of the most fun ones I can dive into is the superpower question. So we ask everyone what their superpower is, and let me tell you, the older generation is not used to answering that question. But we do it on purpose, because we want them to start thinking positively about themselves from the get-go, from the sign-up process. It's really important to us. So the responses we get range from anything from, my superpower is courage, it's empathy, it's resilience. Wonderful. Then we get to, my superpower is time travel. And I'm like, oh, you're going to be a fun one. All the way to, what kind of question is this? They're all fantastic, valid answers. They tell us just as much about who they are from a professional perspective, let's say, as what their personality is. And I think that's where we really see really beautiful correlations. I'll give you a very specific example. We connected a young girl who's 15 at that point, Justine, who was a Haitian immigrant in Miami. She had just immigrated with her parents to the States maybe a year before, and she was in high school. Connected her with 82-year-old Mary Ellen from LA. And Mary Ellen went to Radcliffe. She was on the board of Esalen since 1984. So we connect the two of them. And what Justine tells me, because we do feedback forms, is that she feels like she's looking at a mirror of herself when she talks to Mary Ellen. And so I asked both of them about it. And they discovered in being so curious about each other that they have a shared childhood experience. So when it came time for Justine to navigate the US and navigate getting into a really good school, and Justine is really, really smart, Mary Ellen reached out to the community and got several older adults to help Justine apply to schools and get scholarships.
I love it.
And, you know, when you connect to people that are incredibly different, you almost force them to find what they have in common. And that in itself is the bond. And that creates the joy. So Mary Ellen wrote an email to the person who introduced her to Eldera saying that it was the best introduction she's gotten in 40 years. And it wasn't about Eldera. It was about Justine.
I've been so lucky to have mentors in my life, to have people doing me favors, helping me out. I hope I'm also doing that for other people. And if you can sort of bring that joy to so many people who might not have experienced it for whatever reason, I think is so powerful. And so when you have your younger cohort, it's 6 to 18 year olds, and you're thinking about that intergenerational connection, do you think there's something special about sort of 6 to 18 with the older adults? Are you going to expand to people in your 20s? Like, why focus on that demo? May you change? Or you think that's where sort of the special sauce is?
I started there because I believe that young people need the most support. I mean, it's not just that I believe. Data shows globally that young people need the most support. Young people are also the hardest to build technology for. A lot of people build technology for the 20, 30-year-olds and so forth. But you have to be incredibly mindful about how you build technology that keeps young people safe. And that's what I really, really think that technology has evolved in a way that is only now allowing us to do that well at scale. That's why we started with the kids. They need it the most and we can do it now. We do not build things fast and break things. Like, we're the opposite of that. We're dealing with the two of the most vulnerable populations on the planet. We build very slow, but it also works. Here's the really interesting hack that we've realized lately. So we always have more kids sign up than older adults because parents see their kids use and love Eldera and they tell the other parents. And then for every parent that signs up, 12 new parents sign up. Mentors tell their best friend. So that's a little bit of a problem there that we're solving now with technology, with what we call the wisdom filter. We can talk about that later. But what we've realized now is that parents sign up for Eldera because they want the access to the mentors too. We have really big companies reach out to us saying, we want to offer Eldera as an employee benefit because our employees who are parents are the most stressed generation. And we think that you can help them out both with their parents and their kids. So that's why we will eventually grow into other areas. But I want to clarify that Eldera stands for the era of the elders. So our atomic unit, our core, is the older adult. We look at the older adult not as someone who needs care, but as the person who cares. So when we build technology, it's really to understand what makes them special, which is what we call the wisdom portrait. And how can we offer them opportunities to contribute where they feel incredibly valuable? The first one is connect them to kids, which gives them purpose. They live longer. It's great. The second one, which they kind of already started hacking Eldera doing this, is connecting them to each other in a way that they can age in place. In fact, there are many friendships who started on Eldera. Now they have walking groups. But the third one, and I think what's really, really interesting is that older adults helped me and my team build Eldera. They wrote a 32-page manual on how to Eldera for new mentors. They have this incredible wisdom. They have time on their hands. So we're going to allow down the road for companies to tap into the wisdom, really wisdom reservoir that we're building and get older adults to help them with content, with accounting, with whatever it is on a part-time basis in a way that keeps older adults financially stable long-term. I think we're just building a social infrastructure that allows for older adults to continue to make an impact in the world. So ideally, we're going to be solving multiple problems for multiple people. But really, the core is building this global network of human wisdom.
There's so many different threads here that are super interesting. But like one of them is, what is the way in which you're connecting the kind of elder generations also to each other? And then say a little bit about what you're learning, kind of what are some of the patterns of discovering the wisdom from the elder generations?
So I'd like to take full credit for the older adult to older adult, and I can't. When I mean that older adults are building this with us, they really do. So it was maybe 2 months into Eldera when they called me and they said, sweetheart, it's great talking to the young people, but we want to talk to each other to see what the others are doing to be good mentors. And we're like, oh, okay, cool. Let's do that. So then we started what we call Mentor Council. Every 2 weeks, we do a big group Zoom. And they talk to each other. And then they also tell me how to build Eldera better, which is the most incredible thing I can tell you. Literally everything we build comes from them. After older adults get criminal background checked and trained, they get invited into the platform. And they talk to each other about everything. They start with mentoring. They start with introducing themselves and mentoring. But then they talk about movies and books, and they now have a book club and socials that they all created amongst themselves. So initially it was completely organic. And then what they said is, you know, when I was a new mentor, I was so nervous that I didn't have something special to give, that I wasn't good enough, that, yeah, Judy's great with kids, but I'm not really great with kids. Why would you even want me here? So what we realize, it's very important to connect a new person with an existing mentor who is actually a little more similar to them. This is where it's very interesting. So there are different, completely different types of matching that we look at. I'll give you an example. We never match a kid and older adult in the same geographic area. We did it on purpose because I don't want them meeting in the park. There's a lot of implications for that. The benefit of that is that parents pack up the kids and travel across the country or across the world to meet the mentors. With mentors, the older adults, we do want to connect them in the same geographic area. We do want them to have similarities because then they feel like, if Judy can do it, maybe I could do it too. And that takes me to your second part of the question, which is about the wisdom. How do we really understand the wisdom? There's several inputs that we take into consideration in building this, what we call the wisdom network. So one is the self-expressed profile, which is just scratching the surface. But then every single conversation that happens at Aldera is recorded and archived for safety. That is how we use the AI